Welcome to a psychodelicious conversation on mental health issues and trends from three local mental health professionals in the greater Lansing area. I'm Michael Stratton, LMSW.
And I'm Morgan Bowen, PMHNP.
And I'm Melissa Black, PMHNP, and we're here to provide you with a deep dive into the human experience of consciousness and beyond.
Our aim is to be educational and entertaining, so just kick back and open your ears and your minds.
Hey, I'm Michael Stratton.
I'm Melissa Black.
And I'm Morgan Bowen,
producer, Dedalian.
Dedalian's here with us. This is great. We're all reunited. And today we're going to talk about psychedelics. So this is an interesting thing that what we do is that we rotate who brings up the topic. Mm-hmm. And Morgan brought up the idea of psychedelics and mental health treatment because it's something that's on the horizon. Some people are doing it already.
And yes.
Thought it was an interesting.
Well, and people ask about it a lot. I'm wondering if you guys experience the same thing, but people, mm-hmm. Just in normal everyday life, I think ask about it, but professionally people bring it up. So I thought we could discuss it. It's an important topic because there are people that are kind of, doing it. There's research that is out that supports the use, or at least there's some research that supports the use of different psychedelics. So maybe we'll talk about which ones. And but then there's also this kind of, I like to call it the Wild West.
Yes.
The Wild West of psycho delicious landscape of whatever it may be. That so people are kind of doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and maybe it's mental health and maybe it's not. But
so when people are talking about psychedelics, what specifically what drugs do you come to mind for you?
Well, so I guess three big ones. One is psilocybin, which is
mushrooms.
Yes, I think that is the active ingredient in the magic mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And then ketamine, which is used in Spravato, which is actually an FDA approved medication for depression. Actually, the only one probably that we'll talk about today that is FDA approved, and then MDMA. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, what we used to call ecstasy back in the 90s. And now I think a lot of people call it Molly on the street. I think that's another name for it.
Yes.
Is that your understanding, too?
Some people called it Molly in the 90s, too.
Did they?
Yes.
It was always ecstasy in my circles.
For sure.
So there's, I guess to begin with, there's street drugs, which are, drugs of recreation, drugs of, for some people, abuse. And then there is the, I don't want to say like pure form, but there's the usage of the active ingredients for psychiatric purposes or purposes that influence the body in a therapeutic way.
And I think that they're created in a lab, the approved meds, when it's called a medication or whatever, there's some oversight versus street drugs or recreational drugs where there may, you don't know.
Yes.
It's a question mark.
Yeah. Which I think is a really good point, to highlight, because one of the dangers of sort of, going off into the Wild West the Wild West of the psychodelicious landscape is that a person does not necessarily know exactly what they're doing or what they're getting. If they're buying it, maybe Matthew Perry's death is a good example.
Yeah.
He was receiving ketamine for, for the purpose of depression. At least that's what's been, publicly stated, but he was buying it from, I think both, legit, I'm doing air quotes, legitimate sources, but then also from a dealer of ketamine who's getting it from, I think Mexico is what I read. I guess don't quote me on that, but it wasn't necessarily that the compound, the making of it was problematic, but the amount that he was doing was not what, ended up killing him.
So
big difference between something that's really supervised, comes from a source that you know where the medication or the compound is coming from, as well as under, kind of some guidance or some supervision for safety purposes. I think that's kind of, generally a theme. But Why don't we talk first about our own understanding of psychedelics and, you know, kind of our just like thoughts about psychedelic usage and mental health?
Well, as a child of the 60s.
Are you the leading expert for us?
I'm not the leading expert.
Well, Dedalian, what's your, are you the 70s?
I grew up in the 80s the 70s. So, mm-hmm. yeah, born in the 70s. And I have no input on this conversation. I really don't. This is not something that's been a part of my world. Mm-hmm. And I've never had interest. So,
well, so I think, you know, one of the things I was laughing about is just the cultural differences and kind of understandings of drugs, psychedelics from different time periods that we grew up. So go ahead, Mike. Tell us your.
Well, as a child of the 60s, I was curious at the idea of like, oh, that's dangerous stuff. Stay away from it forever. But when I started working at as a psych tech, I knew other psych techs that were tripping on acid. Mm. And one of them had looked at my handwriting on a chart and said, oh, I see dancing skeletons.
And so they were using acid while they were working?
There was a rumor that some people were.
We're not judging. And this is, you know, 50 plus years ago.
I did become, this was 50 years
ago. I guess I don't generally recommend tripping while you're working.
Don't trip when you work. I became very curious and I decided to try it at one point. I knew someone who knew someone who could provide it to me on a small cost. And so I took a day off of work and just stayed at home in the apartment and just said, okay, I got some tunes here. I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm not going to drive anywhere. And I did experience that at that time. And it was, and I was just interested to see what it was like and what happened. And it was definitely a shift in my perception. I remember laying out on the grass and feeling like it was the earth that was breathing, not me. Hmm. And seeing cars drive by, and it felt like the cars were sentient and the people were trapped inside. They all had panicked look on their faces. It was just, so there were some different shifts like that that were interesting. And I did it a number of times after that and then stopped because it just felt, I had the proverbial bad trip where it was like in a obsessive loop that I couldn't get out of. And that felt really uncomfortable. So I decided, I don't think I need to do this anymore. So
I wish that I had gotten it out of, I have it in a box at home. It's a little like notepad from when I was almost 17 and tripped acid for the first time. And I wrote poems and wrote stuff for at least a portion of that time. And one of the things that I remember writing was, you know, the lush green grass, like the earth is breathing.
Yeah.
Like I remember laying down on, you know, on my stomach, you know, with my cheek against the lawn, and just feeling extremely at peace.
Yeah.
How interesting. Well, I think, you know, one of the common experiences is, well, themes of using a psychedelic is a shift in perspective, at least while you're using it, that may then influence your worldview, consciousness in outside of that. Do you feel like tripping or using psychedelics like changed you in some sort of way or changed the way you thought about things?
For me, thinking about this, I remember as a middle schooler listening to an adult talk about how they'd grown up in the 60s, you know, come of age in the 60s, that they had taken acid in the 60s and described it in a way that was very even just like intriguing to me. I was always interested in humanity and, you know, just life and all of the things.
The lived experience.
Yeah,
the experience of, you know, fill in the blank.
And I remember listening to them as like an 11-year-old going like, I think I might want to try that one day. Like I already in my mind knew I would never do cocaine. I would never do heroin. Like I would, I did not like alcohol, saw what it was doing to other folks. But it was like, maybe I'll do that. And I kind of filed that away. I remember a couple of years before I had that first experience reading Siddhartha in ninth grade English and about the river and the mindfulness. And I would say that my experience with that psychedelic, with my worldview, it basically reinforced what had kind of gotten started when I read Siddhartha. So I don't know if it brought a total new understanding, but it reinforced some of the like mindful like grounded stuff that I was into.
And it brings in an important topic. You know, I was doing some reading and just kind of reviewing ideas behind psychedelics because there's definitely a spirituality vibe to a lot of psychedelic use. And culturally, cultures that have used psychedelics as part of a ceremony or some type of ritual.
Ayahuasca.
Yeah, which I'm definitely not an expert on. I have a background in anthropology, so this stuff is interesting to me. But there is, you know, the cultural use. And go ahead with ayahuasca. Do you know about where?
I know people that have done it, that were encouraging other people to.
Yeah, so ayahuasca and peyote as well.
Yeah.
And so I have read books, and I'm trying to remember which one, but in the 40s or the 50s, I think there was a, I think it was ayahuasca. There was stories of its usage in indigenous cultures in Mexico.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so somebody went to Mexico, some, you know, person from the United States seeking
this. Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, someone like that.
Yeah.
And the whole Carlos Castaneda.
And there was like the who was the dude that wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Ken Kesey.
Well, that was kind of, so then there was the natural, you know, psychedelics that come from natural use, and then the creation of LSD, which was lab created,
and like East Coast Ram Dass,
and then I think that's, you know, that's what Grateful Dead, 60s, you know, stuff that you were referring to.
Well, the Army was doing,
they
were trying to do studies, and Ken Kesey was one of their study students, and he was working as a psych tech. So during the day, he'd be tripping, and they thought that they thought it was like maybe a truth serum or something, so they'd be giving people these doses, and then he'd go to work. And one day, he looked down the hallway, and he saw this big Native American guy mopping the floor, and that image became the nut that he drew One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest around, and he wrote that book. And it's interesting because he started to be, he traveled with the Merry Pranksters and went across the country in a bus, and they were trip people. They'd have parties and spike the punch.
Was this a Grateful Dead thing, or this is separate than Grateful,
Grateful Dead? Was
this
like
Grateful
Dead was like their house band almost. Mm. So it was going hand in hand. So I know a lot about that psychedelic scene and that, which was part of what fueled my curiosity.
I think growing up in the 90s, there was such a mythology of that.
Yes.
And it was like, there was definitely a thing in the 90s of trying to recapture the experience of the 60s.
Even like the cars in my school parking lot, like everyone wanted like their, you know, 60s, you know, like muscle type cars.
Bell bottoms. Yes. Lots of hippie. Yeah.
Dazed and Confused.
Girls. 80s, obviously very much war on drugs. I was taught to fear it. All of this, you know, everything, including marijuana. I mean, that's just the 80s.
And it can be scary. It can trigger psychosis.
Absolutely. There's definitely, I mean, we will talk more in depth. I mean, this is not a condoning everybody just going out and using psychedelics.
Well, Melissa said she had a great time.
Everybody.
Like, no, yes, I.
My nurse practitioner.
All therapists do drugs?
No. But why, you know, why do you think now in this cultural moment, like psychedelics are such a hot topic?
Do you want to take it first, or do you?
I only have one thing. I think it's because people are like, the meds aren't helping, or the world is getting more painful and bananas, so people are just seeking.
Because now you hear it more in psychedelics for mental health purposes.
Yeah.
There seems to be just a really, I want to say blanket validation of just like the usage of you know, psychedelics for mental health purposes that may be, it may not be totally a function of the research that has validated this. I think the cultural vibe is much bigger than what the science-based arena has said about psychedelics.
And some of the gurus in the field are starting to lean that way. Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote The Body Keeps the Score, who always said, you know, if you want to deal with trauma, do EMDR and yoga. Now he's saying, well, also consider psychedelics, you know? And so he's working with people in that field. He did psychedelics himself, did not have a good trip, backed off of doing clinical work. after doing psychedelics because he realized, like, oh my God, I'm carrying so much trauma myself from working with trauma for so many years. I heard him give this talk not too long ago. And so I think that there's been, I think there is a shift about exploring new avenues, but it is so much of it is the Wild West. Now, something occurred while I was in Italy a couple of weeks ago, which I didn't know about until I got back. And that is, did you guys know about the executive order that Trump signed on psychedelics?
I had heard something about
it.
No. I did. I read it because I was interested in, but go ahead.
He's pushing evidence-based, he wants to green light the research into psychedelics. And when I dug into that a little bit, it came as a result of a conversation he had with Joe Rogan. I don't think Trump cares about psychedelics. I don't think he cares about health at all.
He's like a famous teetotaler, right? Oh, like he doesn't use drugs or drink.
He is, and he undercuts medicine as often as he can.
Well, he needs.
But I think he cares about Joe Rogan's population, and Joe Rogan had started to speak bad things about Trump, and so to get him back on the good side, Joe Rogan said, "Hey, I think psychedelics are cool." And Trump said, "Well, let's get this moving.
Let's do something about that."
That's my belief. I totally made that up, but like, I think I'm right.
Psychedelics flood the brain with serotonin, but so it just boggles my mind that at the same time that's happening, you know, our RFK Jr. person is saying, "Well, we need to do less antidepressants," when they both have very similar actions in the brain.
Well, I think the legend, I guess I'll say it that way, the legend or mythos of psychedelics for mental health, because there is some research that really does validate the usage.
With alcoholism.
Yes.
The LSD with alcoholics had a really good, interesting, productive use.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And
just I've heard from folks that have really struggled to maintain sobriety that what they called microdosing psilocybin for them took their alcohol cravings away.
Yeah, I've definitely heard people talk about it. And I, you know, the experience of people, I guess I was looking into the research and there is, you know, so psilocybin, at least from what I was looking at, has association with depression, helping with depression. There is a couple studies that do show improvement, and they're, you know, the type of studies that we look at and, you know, scientific, so the clinical trials with control sample and, you know, blinded and things like that. And then MDMA with PTSD is one of the, you know, the thrusts in research. And actually, was it last year or the year before, there was a push, there was a presentation to the FDA to approve MDMA for usage in PTSD based on a couple studies that had been done, but they declined to do that. And then ketamine's usage in depression, particularly treatment-resistant depression.
Now, ketamine, though, technically is not a psychedelic. It's more of a dissociative and also painkiller, right? In some way,
I mean, it is actually.
This surprised me when I watched the show The Pit. Give him some ketamine right away. I was like, what?
It's make him unconscious.
Yeah, it's used for conscious sedation.
Yeah.
And has been for a long time. So somebody's shoulder is dislocated and they need to be sedated and also put under, quote unquote, so they're not going to really remember or move.
Yeah.
But you don't want to put them under general anesthesia because that requires respiratory support. And so consciously sedating someone is a way to not have to use general anesthesia, which you have to do in the OR. But it also prevents people from. So propofol and ketamine are two big ones.
Okay. Well, some of the cautions, though, of people who are going out there, and I have clients, too, who are microdosing. But there's like no assessment, you know, there's no control of dosage. I've had people describe, you know, hey, I started to microdose, but I realized I took too much. And, you know, what kind of effect is that going to have someone who.
So do you know where they're getting the medication? Or
at the corner of.
Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor is decriminalized.
Interesting. Yeah, they take trips to Ann Arbor. There's a literally take trips to
Ann Arbor. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So to that's, like somebody in some dude in some house like we did in college.
No, in a store. You go to the weed
it's
store.
Like a cannabis
and they've
store.
Got,
okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
But it can have unexpected effects. Someone who I knew that was microdosing said that they really got depressed after taking it, which is what you wouldn't usually expect. And they just said that that was really uncomfortable, and they backed off. You know, they had a, and they it's interesting the kind of research folks do, because this person had it like a whole schedule, like 2 days on, 1 day off, 2 days on, 1 day off. Take it, don't take it in the morning, but take it at noon. And, you know, they've done a lot of searching with that kind of
stuff.
Now,
did somebody tell them to do it that way? Or how did they
come
up with this?
They're doing their own research. Right. They're quote unquote, do your own research, which is what we, so you can find anything you want to hear on the internets, you know.
That's been very true.
Because people will ask me, oh, do you like do, I'm like, no, not really. Like, we're not. I'm not trained. Like when you go to medical school, if you go to nurse practice, like we're not learning how to do microdosing.
But would you be interested if it became legal? Do you think you would open your practice to that?
Thought if there was enough, what I've heard from people is, you know, case reports are, you know, people have found it that I know who I work with, you know, professionally as well as my life, who found it helpful. You know, that is good information, but to me, not confirmatory, it's not really a word, but this is worth disseminating in a practice, you know, in a clinical practice. Cause the risk with that in my mind is, okay, you get known as the, you know, microdoser.
And
so everybody who calls is going to want to microdose. And I'm like, no, that's not what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I'm not opposed to it, but I don't, you know, I don't clinicalize it. That's also not a word. Into my practice.
It's interesting because this
week. It won't. I mean, I wouldn't unless there was guidance from, you know, in my mind, like a clinically sound, you know, legit body.
If there was a clinic in this area that was doing it that you would, you know, potentially consult with, that kind of thing.
Well, if there was a treatment like flow, like, you know, like these are the doses that are safe, like just like with any other medication, like if you overdose someone on an antidepressant, it can have similar effects of taking too much of a psychedelic. So I see them as like kind of similar in what their potentials are, but it's all based on dose. And I think some folks who maybe are looking for microdosing don't realize they're not going to have that psychedelic experience. Mm-hmm. Like that's not
dose,
the goal.
Dose on the person that it lands on, their own biochemistry. You know, some people can smoke a joint and it's fine. Some people can do it and they become psychotic.
Yeah, exactly.
And well, that's where I think a role of a clinical assessment and like how is this being used? Because when you and we're going to talk in our next episode more about clinical stuff. But when you incorporate something into a clinical practice, there's assessment, you know, there's evaluation, diagnosis, treatment evaluation. Is this helping? You know, that kind of thing. So I don't see that. Or I'm not hearing a lot about that.
Yeah, that's not happening right now.
I think people are doing their own assessment and their own evaluation and their own diagnosis and their own treatment plans.
Exactly. Yeah, it's interesting because I actually attended a training this week that was online. It was a Zoom, and I just saw it after you had brought up, like, are we going to do psychedelics? Mm-hmm, I just Googled it. It was like, oh, my God, there's a training. It's on Monday afternoon. I can do that. And it was a 1 hour training. And the big thrust of the training is get more training. but she did talk about the attitude of therapists towards it and taking out like a harm reduction perspective, people are going to use. And some people are very, very clear. I'm not going to use any substance. It alters my consciousness. And other people are like, oh, I'm a voyager, you know, I'm an astronaut, I'll try something. But to be able to do that with harm reduction, you know, non-judgmental.
Yeah, and to dialogue with somebody.
And do a real clear assessment, you know, what do you want to have happen? What do you expect to have happen? What are you worried about happening? Is this going to be, is it going to be supervised? Is this a short-term, hour-long? Do you want to do it in my presence? You know, really microdose and see what that's like? You know, just different things along those lines.
And so we've discussed a lot of topics, and we are going to continue in part two, and see you then. A Psychodelicious Conversation is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is no substitute for therapy and should not be treated as such. If you feel a need for real therapy, you should consult your local provider, Google Therapy, or therapist in your area. Check your community mental health or a suicide hotline if you are feeling suicidal.
Mike, Morgan, and Melissa welcome your questions, feedback, or dilemmas. Feel free to send your emails to psych.delish@gmail.com. That's psych.delish@gmail.com.
The views expressed on this podcast are solely the opinions of Mike Stratton, Morgan Bowen, and Melissa Black, and do not reflect the views or opinions of any site broadcasting this podcast. Replication of this podcast without written permission is strictly prohibited.